And good afternoon. You're listening to Ken Hudnall. This is a Ken Hudnall Show. Coming to you from our studios in exciting El Paso, Texas. Gateway to the Old West and the most haunted city in the country. Well, the clown show continues. Nadler is now the ringmaster. And they have brought forth two allegations. Obstruction of Congress and abuse of authority. Now, even though the president is the chief executive officer of the country, Congress is incensed that he didn't have their permission to breathe. And, of course, obstruction of Congress. Well, what happens every time a congressman decides he's just going to go screw off? As most of them do, most of the time. It's a joke, but next week it's going to come to a vote. And personally, I think you'll see a lot of Democratic Congress people having to actually get real jobs when they get defeated by their opposition this next election. Well, we have, today is Friday the 13th. And I had somebody ask me the other day, why is Friday the 13th considered unlucky? Well, my understanding is it goes back to the Knights Templar. When Philip the Fair, the King of France, who had, according to everything I've read, had his agents poison the Pope so they could replace him with one of his own cronies, gave the orders that on a certain day at a certain time, all the Knights Templars were going to be arrested because he wanted their treasury. And the arrests were going to happen on Friday the 13th. Well, when it came time for the arrest, they got a couple of hundred, but most couldn't be found, and the entire treasury and the Templar fleet had disappeared. So, from everything I can understand, that is the basis for Friday the 13th being considered unlucky. Well, we've been talking for the last two nights about the Battle of Los Angeles. Very curious event that took place on the 24th and 25th, the night of the 24th, morning of the 25th of February 1942. Now, it occurred less than 3 months after the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor. And only a day after a Japanese submarine, the 1-17, bombarded Elwood. Now, at the time it happened, everyone was sure it was a Japanese aerial attack. But the Secretary of the Navy was adamant that it wasn't. And after 10 tons of munitions were expended, not a single Japanese aircraft was brought down, or any aircraft for that matter. Now, at 3:16 a.m., the 37th Coast Artillery Brigade began firing 50 caliber machine guns and 12.8-pound anti-aircraft shells at an unidentified aerial object. Pilots were alerted, but there's no record of any military planes being set up to oppose this flying object. Firing continued until 4:14 a.m., when the all clear was sounded and the blackout had been lifted. Within a few hours of the raid being terminated, Secretary of the Navy held a press briefing in which he attributed the incident to what he called war nerves. You know, that pretty much set the parameters for how the government treated UFO sightings. You just imagined it. Here he's saying the military guardians of Los Angeles just imagined it. Now, the press, of course, in those days was independent. They didn't get their marching orders from the Speaker of the House or the Democratic Party. They reported the facts. And they were speculating that this was a Japanese attack, either from secret bases in northern Mexico or a fleet of Japanese submarines offshore. Now, yes, there were Japanese submarines offshore, no question about that. Another theory was that the U.S. government staged the whole thing deliberately to give it an excuse to move defense industries situated on the coast to sites further inland. In fact, Santa Monica Congressman Leland Ford was promised that a disaster would lead to that. And in fact, he made a speech demanding a full congressional investigation. He was ignored, which is what Congress does when it doesn't like what it hears. It just ignores it, unless it wants to use it for its own benefit. Well, at the time all this was playing out, Pearl Harbor was still very fresh in people's minds. And there had been a submarine attack on Elwood the day before, which caused a great sense of panic among the populace. So with this backdrop, it's not surprising the event became a major news story, and conspiracy theories continue to this day. Now, the devastation caused by the raid on Pearl Harbor was magnified by Japanese naval activity, and Japan even sent 7 submarines to patrol the west coast of America. And twice, these submarines became involved in fights with American naval or air forces, and they sank a number of merchant ships. By late December, though, they had returned to Japan for maintenance and more supplies. Japanese submarine 1-17 then returned to the American waters. Now, before the war, its commander, Kozo Nishino, had been in charge of a merchant ship and refilled his vessel with oil before returning to Japan. And while walking to the refinery, he tripped and fell into some prickly pear cactus. The oil workers thought it was hilarious. He had to have cactus spines removed from his buttocks, and there was speculation this incident may have led Nishino to target the oil refinery when his submarine surfaced within range of it. He ordered his gun crew to fire at an aviation fuel tank, and their initial gunfire landed very close to the storage tanks. The few oil workers on duty at first thought the noise was due to an internal explosion, and then one of them glanced to see and saw the submarine's silhouette against the night sky. When the second tank was targeted, the refinery staff immediately called the police, but several rounds had been fired by the sub by the time that decision was made. More shells hit a nearby ranch. Another passed over Wheeler's Inn, and the Santa Barbara County Sheriff's Office was called. Another shell struck and damaged the Elwood Pier. Firing destroyed a derrick and a pump house and damaged a catwalk. The whole operation lasted for 20 minutes before Nishino gave the order to his crew to cease firing. They fired, some say 13, some say 15 shells in all. Soon as news of the attack spread, planes were sent to the area to pursue the raider. 3 more bombers joined the attempt to destroy the submarine, but none were able to hit their target. Air Force commanders only deployed these small quantities of aircraft because they feared the raid was a diversionary one to decoy the resources away from the real target. Japanese Americans who were loyal to the U.S. immediately warned that the next day might see an aerial assault on L.A. So when it happened, of course, everyone assumed it was a Japanese aerial invasion. Now, the Elwood attack, which was really not that much, created panic all out of proportion to its effectiveness. With the memory of the air raid fresh in people's minds, the following day saw a sustained aerial battle against an unknown and unidentified intruder. Now, in spite of most folks saying we didn't have working radar in 1941, 1942, there's evidence that we did. And that radar identified an unidentified object at 120 miles out. Now, following the Elwood raid, naval intelligence warned of an attack within the next 10 hours or so. And that evening, there were many reports of flares and flashing lights in the region of defense plants. Eventually, all the various alerts were canceled, but morning of the 25th of February, hostilities commenced in earnest. Now, who they were commenced against? Anybody's guess. Radar operators picked up a target 120 miles to the west of Los Angeles. It just suddenly appeared. Air Force planes, or Army Air Corps as they were at that time, remained on the ground, but anti-aircraft batteries were put in a state of readiness. Radar tracking pointed to a target that was only a few miles off the coast. And at 2:21 a.m., a blackout was ordered. And soon, reports of sightings of enemy planes began to flow in to authorities. Now, all trace of the initial target vanished from the radar. However, the way the radar was at that point in time, you could drop below the area the radar could see. And witnesses reported seeing planes in the vicinity of Long Beach, and a colonel in the Coastal Artillery reported seeing about 25 planes at 12,000 feet over the city of L.A. 20 minutes later, a balloon with a red flare was observed over Santa Monica. Four anti-aircraft batteries immediately attacked it. Following their assault on the balloon, witnesses said the air over L.A. erupted like a volcano. Now, what I'm giving you today are reports in addition to the reports I had for yesterday and Wednesday. Now, at 3:16 a.m., were the air raid sirens, anti-aircraft machine guns began firing at targets from Santa Monica to Culver City. 1,440 rounds, more or less, were fired. That's almost not quite 10 tons. Thousands of people saw anti-aircraft batteries firing, and there were many witnesses of the strange events to that morning. The reports are not consistent by any means and sometimes appear confused. Some witnesses describe a craft that resembled a Zeppelin airship. Others insist the object is more like a balloon. A number describe seeing aircraft. Other reports claim the object resembled a giant butterfly or even a coffee pot. In the confusion and panic, it's understandable witnesses gave different accounts of what they saw. But it's more surprising not only some aircraft gunners, but also pilots described the events differently. Some observers described very clearly seeing a single object. But others reported an entire squadron or Japanese aircraft or a fleet of airships they insist of being chased by U.S. fighters. At the time, nobody suggested what we today call UFOs. extraterrestrial invaders, I guess is another way to put it. Now, following the bizarre battle, newspapers put forward a series of wild theories to account for the strange events. Some claim Japanese aircraft flown right across L.A. and that the military were too embarrassed to admit they'd been caught out by the invaders. And, of course, one of the big theories at the time was the defense manufacturers had organized a phony raid using civilian planes to frighten the government into allowing them to move their factories further inland. Not a single iota's proof of that particular theory. Various government departments unable to agree on either the details of what had taken place or an explanation for it. Frank Knox, Secretary of the Navy, announced in no uncertain terms on the 25th at a press conference. The raid was a false alarm. War nerves. He admitted the west coast of America was now vulnerable to enemy attack and suggested any vital factories or other manufacturing facilities by the sea should be moved inland. So from that point of view, it certainly was within the realm of possibility that this was done in order to move defense industries. The Army wasn't really certain what had happened that night. Western Defense Command sent a report to Washington after the raid that suggested it was highly probable that no attack had taken place. They announced that most previous reports had been greatly exaggerated. Fourth Air Force also stated that no aircraft of any kind had flown over L.A. that night that they could account for. Next day, following interviews with many eyewitnesses, the Army decided there had been between one and five unidentified planes flying over L.A. For those who followed John Belushi's movies, none of them were flown by Captain Wild Bill Kelso, though. Then became the official War Department explanation for the incident. Secretary of War Henry Stimson put forward two possible theories as to what the mysterious aircraft were. One was there were light aircraft launched from Japanese submarines, which would have been a good move on the part of the Japanese. And the other was there were commercial planes flown by the Japanese from concealed sites hidden in Southern California or Mexico. He believed they were reconnaissance aircraft trying to locate anti-aircraft defense facilities in the area, and boy, did they find out where they were. And it also had the intent of demoralizing civilian morale, and it certainly did that. Well, the media, which, as I say, at the time was independent of the Democratic Party, unconvinced by the various official explanations, perplexed by the different solutions offered, began to make accusations of a cover-up. They'd never do that today, because if Nancy Pelosi lifted a finger, somebody'd run kiss it. February 26th, L.A. Times carried a front-page editorial declaring the official explanations made no sense. View the considerable public excitement and confusion caused by the events. The article went on to say a proper investigation was necessary and the public had a right to know the truth. February 27th, the Washington Post described the authorities having maintained what it called a stubborn silence and having panicked in the face of uncertain events. Newspaper dismissed the Army's suggestion of commercial aircraft, declaring it explains everything except where the planes came from, where they were going, and why no American planes will sit in pursuit. New York Times, on the 28th of February, published an article and made it clear they found the whole affair utterly baffling. It went on to say, if the batteries were firing on nothing at all, as Secretary Knox implies, it's a sign of expensive incompetence and jitters. If the batteries are flying on real planes, some of them as low as 9,000 feet, as Secretary Stimson declares, why were they completely ineffective? And most of all, why were no American planes sent up to engage them or even try to identify them? I mean, they raised the interesting question, what would have happened if this had been a real air raid? Reality was, the American anti-aircraft defenses were totally unprepared for any kind of air raid. And had the strange events of that night been a genuine Japanese attack, we'd have hurt ourselves more than we'd have hurt the enemy. At the end of the war, when they were specifically asked about the Los Angeles affair, the Japanese authorities said that none of their planes had been in that area at the time. A few were launched from submarines operated off Seattle at a later date, but on the night in question, not a single Japanese aircraft was anywhere near Los Angeles. Well, there is no evidence that Japanese fighters or bombers were involved, and since so little damage was done, it's virtually certain the events of the Battle of Los Angeles were not the result of enemy invasion. Official explanation after the war was that meteorological balloons released over L.A. had been mistaken for enemy aircraft. And it's certain that the targets at which the anti-aircraft guns were firing were moving too slowly to have been Japanese planes, or anybody's planes for that matter. Once the firing had begun, the smoke in the atmosphere made accurate identification difficult, and with the general air of panic, it's not surprising that firing continued in spite of the lack of evidence of any actual enemy in the air. Commander of the brigade in the area admitted that initially he thought he'd seen 15 planes in the sky, but soon realized that smoke from the gunfire was misleading him. And some witnesses who saw the intensity of gunfire said they could never distinguish the shape of an aircraft. It's also curious the planes made no attempt to bomb the area, even though it contained valuable military installations. Simpson's suggestion the aircraft were engaged in reconnaissance is plausible, but there's no evidence to support it. The failure of the majority of witnesses to observe any indisputable signs of planes makes that theory highly unlikely. Another suggested explanation is that the witnesses saw a secret Japanese weapon called the Fugo bombing balloon. And these devices, as I said last night, did exist, but they weren't launched against the U.S. until 1944. According to Japanese records, design work on them didn't even begin till late 42, so they couldn't have been used in the attack on Los Angeles. Now, you know, frankly, the concept of balloons as long-range weapons is older than the Japanese weapons, but a British study into their effectiveness began as early as 1937. We discussed Operation Outward last night, which was approved in late 41 and launched its first offensive balloons in March of 42 against German-occupied France. And it continued till D-Day and ended completely in September of 44. Now, there's absolutely no evidence the Japanese used balloons in war before the Fugo project in late 42, but, you know, frankly, when you get right down to it, it's not impossible they might have done so, at least on a let's-see-what-happens basis. Down there, the situation resulted entirely from the panic following the Elwood raid is hard to reconcile with the fact that an object was detected by radar operators. It came in from the Pacific and was moving slowly toward the land. And this was followed by reports of Japanese planes being sighted over Southern California. Artillery fire was a result of this state of a panic as the U.S. was unprepared for an enemy attack. An anti-aircraft unit shot wildly at what they presumed were invaders. Now, there were reports of Japanese planes having crashed as a result of this firing, but subsequent investigation failed to find any sign of it. Now, it's difficult to imagine that even such a major misidentification could have led to anti-aircraft fire lasting for an hour and a half. You know, war nerves and smoke from the anti-aircraft fire played a part in creating the event, and the situation wasn't helped by contradictory stories from the military and the different theories put forward to explain it by different spokesmen. With all this genuine confusion coupled with deliberate disinformation, it's hardly surprising that conspiracy theorists have become so involved in the story. Now, one of the most popular urban legends, I guess you can say, about the events of the day is the craft seen in the sky resembled a giant butterfly. Well, when you trace it back, the original source for this story was an article in the Reno Evening Gazette, dated February 26, 1942. Headline was "Los Angeles Confused Over the Air Raid Alarm." Well, a careful study of this news item showed at no point was any mention made of a giant butterfly. Claim wasn't put forward until the 60s, following the Mothman UFO sightings. And at that time, these Mothman sightings, which was of a man-sized flying creature in West Virginia, was compared with the events of 1942. Now, since the Reno Evening Gazette made no mention of any kind of giant butterfly, the theory didn't have anything to support it. And neither the media of the time nor eyewitnesses to the events described anything like this. Another myth about the battle is that no attempt was made to scramble aircraft to investigate and take action against any enemy intruders. Well, nearly an hour passed between the initial air raid alert and the beginnings of anti-aircraft fire. Planes were, in fact, sitting on the runway ready to go, but there was not many fighter aircraft in the area, and the decision was made to wait developments before committing them to possible aerial combat. We didn't even know how many planes were in the air over L.A. Now, another curious aspect of this situation is the involvement of radar. Officially, the U.S. didn't possess a radar system at the time of the raid, but a government document dated 1983 claims that there was a form of radar in existence as early as 1942. Now, it was certainly not as advanced as later radar systems, but it shows it. Many secret weapons were available to both sides during the war at much earlier dates than previously believed. Now, the radar system in use at the time was an SCR-268. The system allegedly had a range of only 22 miles, but the mystery object was detected on radar at a distance of 120 miles from L.A. Now, there's a logical explanation, of course. U.S. radar was probably much more sophisticated and powerful than authorities are willing to admit to the public. Military secret, don't you know? The range of the SCR-268 really had been only 22 miles. It would have been impossible for radar operators to have identified the object at a much greater distance than their acknowledged capability. So when it was reported, they identified this craft at 120 miles out. They're saying that they did, in fact, have a sophisticated radar system. And in 1947, the microwave radar, which we know was in existence because we even had two mobile trucks, may well have brought down the craft at Roswell. So what's the end result? Well, clearly, there were war nerves, and the Elwood attack played a part in all this. Even our U.S. military was confused and gave contradictory accounts of the events of that day. The most significant fact in all the eyewitness stories is that the anti-aircraft battery that was closest to the phenomena chose not to open fire. They clearly recognized whatever it was they saw was not a hostile aircraft, so they didn't make any attempt to shoot it down. Other battalions with an inferior view of the craft panicked and began to fire. The balloons in the area, of course, didn't help, but all the batteries had been releasing balloons every 6 hours, so they shouldn't have been confused by meteorological balloons. Now, many of the civilian observers may have been confused by the balloons. But at the end of the day, what was it that flew over Los Angeles? And the best reports we have is of a huge aerial object that stayed in the shadow of the mountains to avoid not only as much radar as they could, but the weapons of the more powerful batteries that were stationed in the area. So that raises a number of interesting questions. Now, I had a couple of other interesting questions that I was going to make into individual shows. But since we've got some time left tonight, since this is my third installment of the Battle of Los Angeles, I was asked what I thought about the mysterious disappearance of Glenn Miller. Now, for those of you that don't remember Glenn Miller, he was a well-known band leader of the 30s. In fact, he was considered the most successful band leader of his era. He was called the King of Swing, and he was at the height of his fame in 1942 when he disbanded his orchestra and joined the Army Specialist Corps. That same year, he transferred to the Army Air Force, and he proceeded to introduce swing music into military marches, which certainly did a lot for the morale of the soldiers. Now, while in the military, he created a new orchestra and began giving concerts to the troops. March 20th, 1943, the 418th Army Air Force Band gave its first performance. He was desperate to play to American service personnel overseas and eventually got permission. He took his band on the road. His now British-based band was enthusiastically welcomed by the troops. Lieutenant General James Doolittle told him next to a letter from home, "Your orchestra is the greatest morale booster in European theater of operations." When Miller and his band paid concerts in airfields, aircraft hangars, performed on the American Forces Network, even appeared on a show called the Wehrmacht Hour, which mixed swing music with propaganda, he tried to speak German for the program. His first address in London was 25 Sloane Court, but this area was a favorite target of the V1 Doodlebug, so he decided to relocate the orchestra to Bedford, north of London. Very next day, a V1 rocket crashed right in front of their former lodgings, destroying the building and killing over 100 people. Well, when asked what he thought about it, Miller made the comment, "As long as the Miller luck stays with us, we got nothing to worry about." Well, Miller and his band were playing at an open-air performance in Kent. The sound of the V1s was heard overhead. The audience dove for cover, but Miller and his orchestra continued playing. After the explosion, the audience returned and gave him a standing ovation. Well, his workload was intense and demanding. In 1 month, he played 35 live concerts and made 46 broadcasts. And even though he was tired, he wanted to perform for the troops in France. And in late 44, it was agreed he and his band could move to Paris and play a concert on Christmas Day. November 15th, the band's manager was given permission to fly to Paris and make the arrangements. And then Miller made the announcement that he planned to go. Now, the weather was poor. Thick fog made flying difficult. And because of the bad weather, the Supreme Headquarters Allied Expeditionary Force, or SHAFE it was called, shuttle in which he was to fly was grounded. Well, on December 14th, Miller met Lieutenant Colonel Norman Bissell, who was flying to Paris the following day in a UC-64A Norseman light aircraft. Bissell invited Miller to fly to France with him. It was raining, visibility was poor, but the plane still took off. and vanished. Miller and Brazil and the pilot all disappeared without a trace. Well, nobody knew Miller was missing till the 18th of December because he boarded the Norseman without permission or the knowledge of senior officers. Board of Inquiry was set up by the 8th Air Force that had concluded that the Norseman had been lost in the English Channel. Bad weather, pilot error, possible engine failure. These were the probable causes that were mentioned in the report. Remember one thing about military reports. There's going to be a CYA clause. CYA means cover your ass. Well, that was the official verdict. Bad weather, pilot error, engine failure. But then the conspiracy theories began. German journalist Udo Ufkoti told Bild newspaper in 1997 he had secret evidence Miller was never on board the Norseman. Instead, he'd flown to Paris the previous day and died of a heart attack in a Paris brothel. Official version of his death was a cover-up to protect Miller's reputation. Now, Ufkoti admitted he had no evidence for his claims, but he said that he was given that information from German intelligence sources. Now, I'd heard a version of that story that he did arrive in France. He did go to a brothel. He was known as a ladies' man. And whether accidentally or on purpose, he died leaving the building. Well, his death was covered up because nobody wanted to, number one, admit that he was there unofficially. Number two, that they couldn't protect somebody as well known as Glenn Miller. Now, retired U.S. Colonel Hunton Downs came up with another conspiracy theory. He claims Miller was a super spy for the OSS, and he died on an undercover mission. Downs claimed that Miller's mission was to contact German generals and persuade him to overthrow Hitler. But the plan failed, and Miller was captured. Then he was tortured and killed by the Nazis, and his corpse was dumped on the doorsteps of a Paris brothel. The story of the Northman's crash was invented to protect his reputation. Certainly his wife would not have been happy to find out he spent time in a brothel in France. Well, Miller's younger brother Herb said in 1983, Glenn Miller didn't die in a plane crash over the channel, but from lung cancer in a hospital. According to him, Miller became so ill on the Norseman that the pilot had to make an emergency landing. Miller was taken to a military hospital immediately, but died the next day. Herb Miller said it was his idea to tell the story of a crash in a channel to let his brother be remembered as a hero. Well, Miller was a heavy smoker, there's no question about that. He also made the comment, I'm totally emaciated, although I'm eating enough. Others remarked how thin and ill he looked. Certainly the idea he might have died of lung cancer is plausible. Probably more plausible than the fact he was a spy for the OSS. But there are several objections to this particular theory. Why did Herb Miller wait till 1983 before making his claim? And why is his version of Miller's death not confirmed by military records, or U.S. or British, or even French for that matter? And what will be the purpose of keeping his death in the hospital a secret for so long? Well, what the military considers the most plausible of all the conspiracy theories about Miller's death was put forward by Fred Shaw. Shaw was a former navigator in RAF Bomber Command who'd served on an Avro Lancaster bomber that was returning from a failed raid on German railway yards. When the Lancaster approached the south coast of Britain, it was dropping its bombs over the official South Zetterson zone. See, if they went on a mission and didn't expend all its ordnance, It was thought to be too dangerous to bring it back. What if it crashed coming in for a landing? So they would jettison any ordnance that was left on board in a certain area. Well, he said as they were coming back in, he looked out the window and he saw a Norseman flying beneath his plane. And the rear gunner radioed, "Did you see that aircraft go in?" Well, when you drop the bombs, whether over land or over water, when they hit, there is an explosion. And according to Shaw, the explosion of the unexpended ordnance hitting the ocean surface, the updraft from the explosion caught the Norseman and pulled it down. Now, the Air Historical Branch of the Ministry of Defense has refused to confirm or deny Shaw's claims. Their only response was to say it was possible that the Norseman and the bomber might have crossed in flight. The pilot of the Lancaster, Victor Gregory, partially confirmed the story. He admitted that he saw nothing but recalled both Shaw and the rear gunners saying they had actually seen the Norseman. So, we're left with a number of potential theories to explain his death. Friendly fire, which is what this would have been. There would have at least been a motive for a cover-up. Murder. Illness. Any one of them would have explained the situation. Whatever the truth about what happened to Glenn Miller, folks continued to enjoy his music. It just had that extra air of mystery about it after this. Well, there's another mysterious death involved with World War II. I don't know how many of you remember the actor Leslie Howard. He played Ashley Wilkes in Gone with the Wind, had quite an interesting career going. Well, he was among the passengers on a civilian aircraft flying from Lisbon to London on June 1st, 1943. He was going back to Britain. He was going to work with the British military. Now, he wasn't going to be in uniform. He was going to be a propagandist and support Britain's war effort. Started a number of morale-boosting films, such as First of the Few, in which he played R.J. Mitchell, designer of the Spitfire. Well, Howard wasn't originally a passenger on the DC-3 from Portela, the airport in Lisbon. He and his business manager, Alfred Schenhals, had replaced three other passengers who were taken off the plane. The takeoff went without incident, and the civilian aircraft continued its journey unmolested for the next 2 hours. However, there was a burst of Luftwaffe activity only a few minutes after the plane's departure from Portugal. Eight Junkers Ju-88C6 fighters left their base at Bordeaux and flew westwards. Now, at 12:45 p.m., they saw the DC-3. I mean, it's broad daylight. Excellent visibility. And the aircraft bore unmistakably civilian markings. So it's almost impossible to assume the German pilots thought the plane might be military. In spite of the fact they were clearly facing an unarmed passenger aircraft, the Junkers attacked. This wireless operator sent a frantic message in Morse code to the RAF signal station at Whitechurch in Somerset at 12:54 p.m. Message said from GAGBB, the aircraft number, to GKH. And being attacked by enemy aircraft. And then the transmission ended. The Ju fighters attack and caused the fuel tanks to catch fire and the plane exploded in midair. No survivors. Now, given the impossibility of the Germans mistaking the aircraft for a military plane, you have to ask yourself, why would they shoot it down? It had been premeditated as the Junker squadron left Bordeaux only minutes after the DC-3 took off from Portugal. Well, there are a number of theories about why they might have attacked the craft, and all but one involving the passengers on board. The most obvious one is the one Churchill thought was the case. The Germans believed that Churchill himself was on board the plane. Now, Churchill had been visiting North Africa, and the Germans were aware that he was there. In the book, The History of the Second World War, Churchill's presence led to a tragedy that distressed him. A thick-set man smoking a cigar walked up and was thought to be a passenger on the Junker, the DC-3. And since all those neutral country airfields had German agents, they signaled that Churchill was on the aircraft. Mistaken identity, but signaled that he was on the aircraft. So the theory was that the Germans shot down the aircraft because they thought Churchill was on board. The man everybody thought was Churchill was Leslie Howard's business manager, Alfred Schenhals, who actually bore a striking resemblance to Churchill. And if the Germans believed that Churchill was on board the plane, they might have risked the general displeasure of the free world of shooting down a civilian airliner in order to get Churchill out of the war effort. Two German agents certainly looked at the passenger list of that flight. And many believe they thought Chenhall was a pseudonym for Churchill. And when they physically laid eyes on the man, who did resemble Winston Churchill, they would certainly have passed on the information to the German high command that Churchill might be among the passengers. There's a second theory that Leslie Howard himself was the intended target. He made a propaganda film called Pimpernel Smith, and it totally infuriated Goebbels. And if the Nazis had a hit list, Howard was certainly on it. I mean, let's face it. To their mind, he was everything they didn't like. He was a anti-Nazi. He was doing propaganda films supporting the British. And he had Jewish ancestry. Now, two other passengers might well have been the Nazi targets. One was Wilfred Israel, an exiled German Jew. He helped smuggle thousands of Jews to safety and had flown to Portugal to help Jewish refugees there and in Spain find sanctuary in Palestine. And he had recruited many German Jewish scientists to work on the Manhattan Project, the American atomic bomb program. Ivan Sharp was another possible target. He was an industrialist charged by the British government with buying up tungsten at inflated prices to prevent the Germans from getting it. Nazis might have wanted to get him out of the way, as he was a thorn in their side. And the final possibility is that the plane was shot down totally as a result of an accident. Now, there's no doubt that Ju-88s did patrol the Bay of Biscay to provide air cover for U-boats. And on that fateful afternoon, the Junker squadron was out looking for two submarines they planned to escort to safety. Well, the weather was so bad, they called off the search and instead patrolled the area around them. Then at 12:45 p.m., they spotted the DC-3. 5 minutes later, they prepared to attack. Now, the pilots claimed they couldn't distinguish any markings, but could tell by the shape and construction it wasn't German, so they fired on the plane from above and below, which set the port engine and wing on fire. At that point, the squadron leader realized it was a civilian aircraft and called off the attack, but by that time, the damage was done. The aircraft crashed into the sea and sank. Now, that was the version of events given by three surviving pilots who had been involved in the shooting. It's quite possible they panicked and fired out of fear. The Ju-8H were notoriously slow, and he might have shot first and thought about it later. Of course, there are some problems with that explanation. For months, civilian airliners had been leaving Portugal and flying to Britain on that same air route without any attempt being made to attack them. DC-3 civilian status was clearly in evidence by its markings, and the weather was not poor. It was sunny. And agents in Portugal had certainly told the Abwehr, the German military intelligence, they thought Churchill might be on the plane, and the Junker squadron was scrambled only minutes after the DC-3 took off. Well, we'll probably never know the truth. But the strong probability is the airliner was destroyed because the Germans thought Winston Churchill was on board. Leslie Howard and the other passengers almost certainly died as a result of a case of mistaken identity. Well, there's a third World War II mystery that is, I think, of great interest. The time is the problem. We only have a couple of minutes left in the show, but I'll see how much of this I can get. Now, at the time this murder took place, most of Europe was occupied by the Germans. The neutral countries, Spain, Portugal, Switzerland, Sweden, became hotbeds of intrigue and espionage. Sweden was particularly important because its geographical position meant the German, Soviet, and British agents could operate there relatively freely. In this atmosphere, the glamorous socialite Jane Horney, who was born Eva Carlotta Horney, or Horney, became a key player. Even her origins are in dispute. One version claims she was born in Stockholm. Another story makes her an illegitimate child born in Scotland and adopted by her Swedish father and Danish mother. She was tall, red-headed, considered a beauty by men. Had a husband and a number of lovers. Her husband was a journalist for the pro-Nazi newspaper Aftonbladet, but they divorced after 2 years of marriage. After her divorce, she became part of the Swedish social scene and embarked on a series of affairs. Majority of them were diplomats or servicemen, and many of them were, dare I say it, spies. But Jane Horney had no inhibitions about trading sex for secret. She had affairs with British, German, Russian diplomats and military staff, as well as members of the Danish resistance. And each group she came in contact with suspected her of working for one of the others. Among her lovers was Ronald Turnbull, a special operations executive, SOE, which was a British undercover. Otto Danielson and Martin Lindquist of Swedish military intelligence, the Russian agent Alexander Pavlov, Jürgen Winkel, a member of the Dutch resistance, Karl Heinz Hoffmann, head of the Gestapo in Denmark, and Hermann Siebel, who ran German counterintelligence operations in Scandinavia. Even more intriguing among the list of Horney's many lovers was Horst Gilbert. He worked for the Abwehr in Denmark and reported to directly to Admiral Canaris. Both men were secret anti-Nazi, and either or both of them may have been playing a double game. Gilbert was friendly with Alexandra Kollontai, the Soviet ambassador to Sweden. He contacted her and asked if it would be possible to conclude a separate peace with the Soviet Union. So there was a lot of different things afoot at that point in time. Horney traveled through an underground Danish resistance shuttle to meet Gilbert in Copenhagen, and she did this on numerous occasions. Somehow she obtained a pass, allowing her to travel freely within the occupied countries and visited Germany several times. On her return to Sweden, she passed on any information she had acquired to Swedish intelligence. In March of 1944, she began a liaison with a British agent whose identity remains unknown to this day. For several months, they conducted an affair that, at least on her side, was passionate. She declared to one and all she was in love with him, and when he broke off their relationship, she was heartbroken. Well, we've only got a few minutes left in the show, so rather than get further into this, I'm going to keep the punchline for Monday. So until then, this is Ken Hudnall for The Ken Hudnall Show, saying have a truly great weekend. I'll see you Monday at 6 p.m. Mountain Time.